I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The split screen 70th birthday of the State of Israel last Monday may well be remembered for the clash of words and pictures. Pictures against words like these from presidential daughter Ivanka Trump in Jerusalem, then her father from Washington, back to Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu at the ceremonies.
On behalf of the 45th President of the United States of America, we welcome you officially and for the first time to the Embassy of the United States here in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Thank you.
Congratulations. It's been a long time coming.
What a glorious day. Remember this moment.
In the din and fog of war to the south, it turned out that Israeli soldiers had killed 60 Palestinians rushing Gaza's border with Israel, and they wounded 1,700. This was a juxtaposition of buzzwords and loaded images, realities and truths, as people kept calling them, to challenge and possibly change the grand narrative of where the world is at, and not just in Israel or the Middle East. So we're listening this hour for adjustments in our storylines among a sampling of interested parties, Jewish, Palestinian, American, and more. Susanna Heschel gets us started. She is professor of Jewish studies at the Department of Religion at Dartmouth College. Welcome, Susanna. What have we been seeing this week to change hearts and minds, starting with your own?
To me, it looked like a painting by Bruegel of hell. On the one hand, we have people who were locked in what is an open-air prison of Gaza, locked in there, fenced in there, desperately wanting to get out, wanting to have some kind of regulation of their own lives, like a state, for example, being shot dead for what? For storming the fence. Mm. And while, of course, it is an attack launched against a military installation, it's wrong, you can't do it, but it's not a capital punishment offense. You don't kill people for that. Mm. And to juxtapose that with the celebration in Jerusalem, people standing and smiling, celebrating, utterly indifferent. That's the monstrosity, and that is hell.
Susanna Heschel, I can't not mention that you bear your father's prophetic name, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who marched at Selma with Martin Luther King Jr. 5 decades ago. Make that connection.
You know, my father marched with Dr. King for peace. And he marched with Dr. King in the prophetic tradition, the tradition of the Hebrew prophets that speak about justice, about righteousness, about compassion, about God's compassion for us and our compassion for one another. And that's what is missing for me today. I look at what the United States is doing. I just read in the newspaper 700 children have been taken away from their parents by the United States, taken away from parents seeking asylum in this country. 100 of those children are under the age of 4. They're babies. Who tears a baby away from its parents?
Tell me what you're talking about in what detail you can. What do you mean, people being snatched from their parents, kids?
People entering this country seeking asylum in the United States as refugees, fleeing war, fleeing poverty, and fleeing certain death in their own countries, mostly coming in from Latin America. And they come to the border, and our border guards from the Homeland Security Department, as a way of supposedly trying to discourage the parents from trying to enter the country, they take away their children, and they put them in institutions. Hmm. And according to the New York Times article, these institutions sometimes don't know the names of the parents. So these parents may never again see those children. How will they find them? Babies. Who does this to children? You know what it is for a child to be pulled away from its parents?
Susanna Heschel, come back to Gaza, if you will. Somebody noted to me a connection with the Selma Bridge. What if those marchers, including your father and Dr. King, had been shot because there seemed to be no alternative remedy in a desperate situation? I mean,
of course. And in fact, when they marched from Selma to Montgomery, they had federal troops protecting them. at the order of the president, President Johnson. So, in fact, they were going into a dangerous situation. I understand that. The question is, Palestinians have, in fact, been demonstrating in some areas in a peaceful fashion, and it's not getting them anywhere. What can we do? The situation is desperate because there are no ongoing peace talks, and also because the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, has aligned himself with Trump, and that is a very dangerous thing to do. Let me just say, it's very clear to me that I, as a Jew, we Jews need a state of Israel. After what happened in the Holocaust, after so many centuries of persecution, that's clear, fine. But it doesn't mean that we have to occupy other people. And it's also, I have to say, the responsibility of Egypt and the Egyptian government to open the gates of Gaza and let these people out. It's an impossible situation. Now, for Trump to align himself, to align Israel just with Israel with Trump like this, this is self-destructive. Israel needs a broad coalition of people, and we're losing that. And my question would be, why is it years ago the whole world respected Israel, had sympathy with Israel? What happened? What did we do to lose that? And how can we gain it back? And we can gain it back. We're standing for certain principles. My only fear is that the whole world seems to be losing a sense of what it means to be civilized.
Susanna, you're speaking the strain on the hearts of lots of Americans and American Jews very specifically. We read all the time now about younger American Jews losing interest, losing enthusiasm, losing their connection with Israel. Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic, tweeted this week, his words, "The American Jewish-Israeli Jewish divorce seems to be inching closer. Neither side has a full understanding of the other. Geography may be destiny." Do you want to answer Jeffrey Goldberg?
I don't think it's geography is destiny, but I think that the politics in Israel at the moment are disastrous. And I think the politics in the United States are similarly disastrous. So what can we do but have a change of government regime? That's necessary. My fear is that we're going to end up with this alliance between Netanyahu and Trump in a terrible war against Iran, also with the in coalition with the Saudis. That would be terrible for the United States. In terms of American Jews, only 16% of American Jews supported the move of the embassy to Jerusalem. That's very interesting. But to say that in order to be pro-Israel, you have to be pro-Trump, that's going to be a divorce. That will bring about a terrible, terrible divorce.
Measure the defection not by the numbers, although the 16% is fascinating, but in hearts, one by one. What do you say among your closest Jewish friends? I mean, what's the talk?
Well, the talk is fear that, in some sense, Netanyahu is the canary in the mine shaft. You know, there's a bill being discussed in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, right now, calling for the Knesset to override decisions of the Israeli Supreme Court. In other words, it's a disintegration of the basic foundation of the state. And I see that happening in the United States as well. It's as if somehow, instead of having a state, we can have affinity groups. You know, the billionaires will have their club, and there'll be religious groups, there'll be tribes, and so forth. We come to a state committed as citizens, all of us, for a higher purpose. And that's what we're losing. When I grew up and my father was involved in the civil rights movement, there was a higher purpose. Things weren't about politics. They were about morality. How do we want to live? What do we stand for as Jews? The Jews were thrilled that Jews to this day are so full of respect for my father to march as a Jew, arm in arm with Dr. King. That's what we're losing. And I would like to see that change. I would love to see that change in Israel.
Your father said,
breaking the hearts.
I find this online. Your father said, introducing Martin Luther King to fellow rabbis in conservative Judaism, he said, "Martin Luther King is a sign that God has not forsaken the United States of America." Martin Luther King is a voice, a vision, and a way. It tears your heart out to read those words. 10 days later, Dr. King was assassinated, is the short of it. But surely that vision, that need, that appetite lives.
Yes, it does. And I think that we really do have a longing to be inspired. We're living in an era of moral filth and vulgarity. And it's very hard for the Bible to survive and for religion and for faith and inspiration. But I think we don't want to lose that, because that would be losing our souls. So as much as this government or the government in Israel and plenty of other governments around the world are trying to damage our lives and our society, hopefully our souls will prevail, and let's nurture them and remember what indeed needs to be inspiring. So yes, Dr. King was a sign that God had not forsaken the United States of America. The question is whether we have forsaken God.
And the Poor People's March, Poor People's Campaign this year, led by Reverend William Barber, will sort of put it to the test. To a much smaller point, Suzanne, I just want to ask you, what do you make of the elevation, almost the cult, the fetish around Jerusalem as the capital and now the home of our American embassy?
Jerusalem is incredibly inspiring to people around the world, to Jews, to Christians, to Muslims, to people who aren't in those faiths. So I understand that. Of course, what constitutes Jerusalem geographically is something very different from what Jerusalem means religiously. So geographically, the city was actually formed at the end of the 1967 war by the Israeli cabinet that drew a big circle around what is called the Old City of Jerusalem and called the whole thing Jerusalem. So the Old City is where Jews lived and Muslims and Christians until the late 19th century, when some moved outside the walls of the Old City. All right. But when people say the Jews have longed for Jerusalem for 2,000 years, they don't mean the suburbs or where the mall is located and so forth.
Suzanne Heschel,
so that's a misnomer.
I'd ask you to stand by. This is Open Source. We're talking about the events in Jerusalem and Gaza this week. Coming up, who are those Gazans after all these years? How did they get there? And what did they learn this last week? This is Open Source. Gaza in the news always surfaces contradictory labels. Gazans as victims, as refugees, as prisoners of Israel, sometimes prisoners of their own Hamas leadership. Jihad Abu Salim joins us from Chicago. He's a doctoral candidate in history at New York University. Gazan from a village just south of Gaza City. Jihad Abu Salim, welcome. How did this jarring week reshape the story? How did it shape your own story, reshape it, your own identity?
Good evening to you, Christopher, and to your guests and to the esteemed listeners and audience. This has been a very rough week on me personally. I lost few friends in Gaza, who were protesting near the border fence. It's been very hard watching young people die in these large numbers. It's been very hard counting the death and the dead and the wounded, and it's been very hard looking at the pictures of mourning families who were saying the last goodbye to their friends and beloved. Those were people you cross paths with, people you know, people you went to school with, and all they did was to march and protest, calling for their rights and calling for a better life and calling for dignity.
Remind us, Americans, who are the Gazans and how did they get to be there in that coin slot on the map between Israel and Egypt?
Well, the people who live in the region we call today the Gaza Strip are Palestinians, part of the Palestinian nation. And the term Gaza Strip came to being after 1948, the same year Israel, the State of Israel, was founded. A year also where Palestinians suffered from a huge catastrophe. This in 1948, as the state of Israel was being founded, it was being founded on the ruins of Palestinian towns and cities that were destroyed in that war, and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, almost 1 million Palestinians, were expelled from their towns and villages. And some of these people, some of these refugees, they ended up in a corner of historic Palestine, the region between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River today, that was then called the Gaza Strip. So they sought refuge in the Gaza district of Palestine, and in what would become the Gaza Strip. 200,000 refugees out of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees who were expelled and forced to leave their towns and villages in 1948 as a result of the establishment of the State of Israel. They sought refuge in this corner of Palestine. The Gaza Strip is a very small region. Its area is 140 square miles. It's one of the world's areas with the highest population densities. 2 million people live in 140 square miles. Since 1948, the people who ended up in Gaza, in addition to the people who are originally from the towns and villages of what would become the Gaza Strip, have been trapped in this small region that is that does not have enough resources to attend to the needs and to provide enough dignity for all these people.
Jihad, it sounds ridiculous, but can you give us 70 years in a nutshell? It is a prison, and life sentences are extended to the next generations unto eternity. What keeps the people going? And I should say, Jews also got expelled from a lot of Arab countries 70 years ago, and people do say, why can't the Palestinians just move on?
The expulsion of Arab Jews from Arab countries was indeed an historical injustice. And if today Arab Jews call for their right of return to Arab countries, I will be the first person to stand with them. However, they are not calling for that right now, and they are citizens in a state called Israel. But Palestinians are still stateless because the state of Israel was founded. And of course, I am a Palestinian who studies the plight of the Jewish people in Europe in the first half of the 20th century, and I recognize the difficulties and the hardships and the brutality of the suffering of that the Jewish people went through in Europe and elsewhere. But in order to resolve an historical injustice, the Zionist movement, the political Zionism, the leadership of this strand within the Zionist movement then had a recipe for a solution. And their solution was to establish a state on the ruins of Palestinian towns and villages and to expel Palestinian people from their historic homeland and to keep them outside of the state as refugees so that they keep Jewish majority in that state. The reason why Palestinians are incapable of moving on is because Palestinians do not want to live in a world where demographic realities, where boundaries, where state borders are imposed through the barrel of the gun. Palestinians are attached to their homeland. Palestinians, Muslims and Christians, have been in this land for centuries. They understand it. They know it. They know every single corner of it. They love it. They wrote poetry about it. They danced to music that they created in it. They provided the world with one of the best cuisines. Palestinians belong to this land, and when they ask for the right to return to it, when they commit to it, they are not asking for the impossible, but rather they are committing to their human, to their human right and to their human dignity.
Jihad Abu Salim, a guest from Chicago, graduate student in PhD studies, specializing in the Gaza before 1948, before the so-called Nakba, the catastrophe. I want to come back to you, but I'd like also to ask how we Americans get touched by all this to the extent we do. Steve Simon has a take on it. He's a history professor now at Amherst College. But in the Obama White House, he was the career diplomat who got to oversee Middle East policy from the National Security Council. His new book is called The Long Goodbye, The U.S. and Middle East from the Islamic Revolution, that's 1979, to the Arab Spring. It is one of Steve Simon's themes that an experimental, progressive link between the U.S. and Israel in the time of John Kennedy and David Ben-Gurion is something quite different in Netanyahu and Trump time. I asked him this week about a wisecrack in Jerusalem. I heard that if Israel is our 51st state, it is now as red a state as Alabama.
Yeah, it's completely aligned with the Republican Party. And the ceremony in Jerusalem marking the move of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Arnona in Jerusalem emblematized that fact because you had no representatives of mainstream American Judaism there. The Jewish clergy were all from the Orthodox part of the spectrum. And of course, the other prominent religious participants were Protestants from a very right-wing segment of the evangelical movement. So, you know, the Israeli government now maps almost perfectly onto, you know, the Trump Republican Party in the United States. And, you know, to the extent that this Trumpian Republican Party maintains a lock on American politics, the Israelis, at least from their perspective, are going to be doing quite well.
Steve Simon, you were in the thick of everything President Obama did with the Middle East, with Bibi Netanyahu, and also on the Iran deal. We almost forget how hard President Obama tried to please Bibi Netanyahu. He resupplied Israel's ammunition during the Gaza war. And at the very end of Obama's term, he signed a $38 billion arms deal for 10 years forward with Israel. I mean, what didn't he do?
First, he didn't disarm Iran militarily, which is what the Israelis wanted as the cure for the nuclear program. They felt that the only convincing way to put that program to an end was to bomb it.
When all is said and done, will we see the Iran nuclear deal as the crux of the matter in this rather profound change in our relationship with Israel?
You know, it's hard to say what historians will regard as the pivot point. I think historians are more likely to see this as the product of a long process. A long period of change in Israeli society and politics and changes in the United States. And in the meantime, you know, Israel has diversified its diplomatic portfolio. I don't think the Israelis feel quite as reliant on the United States as they once did. I think they're searching for relationships in parts of the world that won't question Israeli policies, for example, towards the Palestinians. So they're reaching out to India, to China, to Russia, to the southern flank of NATO, particularly Greece. You know, they feel a bit more independent. And I could see, you know, Zionists taking a great deal of pleasure in that. But it does make Israelis less responsive to American concerns that they think don't jibe with their national interest.
The relationship with Israel used to be not just bipartisan, but sort of an all-American thing. Are you saying, in effect, that no, Republican Israel is the foreseeable future, and also that the old marriage doesn't necessarily have to be saved?
You know, the Republican readiness to transform the U.S.-Israel relationship into a kind of political football, to me, it's really distressing. And, you know, it's distressing to the old guard of the American Jewish community. I mean, it was in Mitt Romney's campaign that you really first saw the blatant use of the U.S.-Israeli relationship as a political tool. And it was a trope of Romney's campaign that the United States under Obama had thrown Israel under the bus. Right. He said that repeatedly. We'd betrayed Israel. We'd thrown it under the bus. And then what happened? Obama won a second term by what passes in American politics for a pretty solid margin. it showed that even if you make the Israel issue a political issue, it doesn't win you the election because not enough Americans really care about it.
It's fascinating. In that Pew study, which was done months before the 70th anniversary or the Gaza flare-up, the friendly feeling toward Israel declines remarkably as the sample goes younger, better educated, and female. I mean, that could be called the future of American politics, and it's sour on that relationship.
You know, so long as the U.S.-Israel relationship was a bipartisan matter, there was still hope for a future of the relationship that transcended some of these demographic trends.
Yeah.
But that is just harder to see now.
That was the sometime diplomat and historian Stephen Simon at Amherst. Another important guest to introduce, Amal Bishara, is professor of anthropology at Tufts University. She's American-born of Palestinian parents. We'll get to the Palestinian piece, Amal, but I always want to know what anthropology reveals as a way of looking and seeing moments like this.
Well, for me, anthropology lets me think about politics from the ground up. It lets me look, you know, as much at the protesters as it does at, you know, listen to what the spokespeople are saying, for example, right, or the official ceremonies. And it also helps me to look at those official ceremonies as a kind of a theater that we can see juxtaposed against, you know, the minute-by-minute struggle that we saw going on in Gaza this week.
And you see it how? The word grotesque is overused in this juxtaposition. But
I've been doing grotesque, obscene. I think obscene is one. Hamid Nafisi, he's a film scholar at Columbia. He wrote about obscene in relationship to another moment of Israeli violence, I believe. And it was about how it's really literally unseeable. Like to see that picture of Ivanka next to the protesters who are struggling, you know, for their lives, for their dignity, for their futures, with everything that they have. It is truly obscene to think of that scene of the U.S. Embassy and to know that in some sense it, of course, represents me as a U.S. citizen.
Do you not see something of a constructed scene, too, though, an anniversary, a riot, a military response, a presidential daughter on, you know, on the road? Who thought this up?
Right. I mean, I think it's such a flagrant disrespect to Palestinian history and presence, which obviously fits in with a Netanyahu approach towards Palestinians and fits into a Trump approach to brown and black people, migrants, you know, obviously women. I mean, many, many other groups. So to see that kind of disrespect play out on that stage, it's not a big surprise.
We have to address the Hamas question. Hamas, which seems to rule Gaza. It's got a bad name, even among a lot of Palestinians, though it has been argued that Hamas was invented by Israelis to weaken the more secular PLO, now the Palestinian Authority. What do you see as Hamas's rules of engagement here and its reputation for terrorism?
This protest was really... You're talking, yeah. Sorry. This protest.
But I want jihad on this too.
Go ahead. I mean, this protest was organized and dreamed up by Ahmed Amritima and others like him who wanted to see a nonviolent protest go on, a nonviolent massive protest go on, where Palestinians are asserting their right to return, as well as their demand for the end to the siege. Hamas allowed it to happen, but you know, it couldn't have happened without people's desires and wills and bravery, and also of decades of Palestinian popular protest that have created a tradition of marching on Land Day in March 30th when this began, and on Nakba Day on May 14th. You know, to make these bold showings, you know, arrivals that make a statement.
Jihad, I want your view, and including a response to the Trump line, to Nikki Haley at the UN. Ivanka, too, that Hamas was the villain here.
Well, I'd like to repeat what my colleague Amal said just right now with regards to the nature of the Great Return March in Gaza, which was organized and uplifted by Palestinian civil society, by unions, by women organizations, by youth groups and initiatives, by independent activists, by young people from all over the political and ideological spectrum of Palestinian society. And those were the people who took upon themselves organizing this march. Now, there are two things at stake here. There is the question of Hamas and terrorism. And this is a larger debate that I really cannot respond to in few seconds. But all I can say here is that political violence committed on the part of non-state actors is generally a product of situations and contexts of inequality, of colonialism, of occupation, and a product of situations where people find themselves deprived of their dignity and being traced from one angle of this world, from one corner of this world to another, and they find themselves under massive pressure. So let's put this issue aside. Now, with regards to why the march happened in Gaza, well,
be brief. You got a few seconds on this one, and we'll be back. But go ahead.
The fact that Hamas allowed a civil rights style of a protest to happen, this is something that that the world, the international community, should applaud.
And we'll come back to it. Coming up, media matters too. And the coverage seemed to change this week as social media interacted with the old mainstream. This is Open Source. We're reading the scene from Israel this week, reviewing the drama, in a sense, with Amal Bishara in our studio, Susanna Heschel from Dartmouth, Jihad Abu Salim in Chicago. Who among us sees an opportunity in this very, very changed situation that Steve Simon was describing? A fundamental realignment of our politics and theirs. Do you want to begin on that, Susanna?
You know, we made them an agreement as an international community after the Second World War in particular, but during the course of the last 100 years, that we would have international law, that we would have certain rules, laws for example, engagement in war, laws that would protect human rights. And the question is, we as individual citizens around the world have to decide, do we want this? Do we want a world of peace where we treat one another with decency or not? And that's the fundamental basis for this. And each government will have to abide by those laws. So when the Prime Minister of Israel stands at a ceremony for this American embassy and then at the same time is overseeing the killing of Palestinians in Gaza and gets up and calls it a good day for peace, that's a kind of vulgarity and repudiation of everything it means to be a citizen and to have an international community. So what do we want then? We have to decide as human beings. And it's a serious moment of decision for all of us.
Jihad, I want to know, what's the opportunity to see Gaza, as we almost never do? I mean, I've seen Max Blumenthal's eye-opening, really remarkable film, Killing Gaza, which gave you a sense of walking through an endlessly devastated place. Never saw it really before, never felt it. We've seen Gaza in Joe Sacco cartoons. That's almost the classic way we understand this abstraction. What's the chance of getting to know it?
Well, I mean, what the people of Gaza have done in the past few weeks was an attempt on their part to tell the world that people still can struggle for their rights and ask for their dignity through the means of nonviolent and peaceful protest. And unfortunately, because we live in a world where my colleague Susanna described as a world that no longer uplifts any of these values and principles that the international community agreed on, mainly in the post-World War II era, because we live in this world and because the international community today is led by states that do not really consider or appreciate issues of human rights and issues of oppression of people by state actors and by occupying forces. Because of that, unfortunately, the sacrifices of the people of Gaza, I don't want to say that they were rendered invisible, because a lot of many people of conscience across the world heard our voices and shared their solidarity with us. But unfortunately, we live in a world today where the rule is to disregard human rights and human dignity, not the exception.
I want to get closer to the ground in Gaza. I want to know what these people are eating. I want to know why they're not zombies. I want to know how do they get themselves up, as many of them do, to go to work in Israel day to day.
Well, Gaza has been closed off to Israeli labor market since the early 2000s, since the start of the Palestinian Second Intifada in the year 2000, following a series of Israeli policies of closure and isolation that started in the early 1990s. So the numbers of Palestinian workers who used to work in Israel started to decline beginning the 1990s. And let me tell you something. Gaza is a place where people are hardworking people. You know, Gaza is, despite the shortage of land and water and resources, people have been able to be resilient and to stand in the face of this brutal blockade that continued for 11 years. My 17-year-old sister, who lives in Gaza today, she never experienced living in a world with 24 hours of electricity a day. She does not know what 24 hours of electricity a day mean. However, my younger sister, she's now finishing high school and she's studying English and she's reading Harry Potter and she's watching all these TV shows in her 4 hours of electricity a day, and she's studying on candlelight so that one day she wants to come here and study journalism and to tell her people's story. Gaza is a beacon of hope in this time of counter-revolution, in this time of the world's complicity and disregard of human rights and of human values.
Stand by, Jihad, if you would. I want to ask Amal Bishara, what is the challenge, the opportunity for media to report this story with something closer to reality?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say thank you for having us all here today.
It's
and
pleasure.
I also want to say, Jihad, I'm sorry for your loss this week, your losses. And also Ramadan Kareem to all of our Muslim listeners. First day of Ramadan. I also want to say I agree that Gaza is the beacon, is a beacon at this dark time. It humbles me to think about the struggles that people with so many challenges are making in such a bold way.
I want you to speak about one tiny moment in media history. But the New York Times had headlines online and in the paper about Palestinians dying in Gaza, and they got bombarded on social media about, what was this, a sudden flu hits Gaza or something? And they changed the headline. I have it here in Tuesday morning's paper, Israelis kill dozens in Gaza.
Yeah.
What about, you know, calling a spade and a killing, a killing, a shooting?
Well,
a murder.
Yeah, this. I mean, unfortunately, this is a pattern we've seen over and over again. I think there's a piece in the Guardian today. You know, the bullets are not hanging in the air for Palestinians to run into them. Right, there is an agent that's shooting Palestinians. It is the Israeli army, and they are doing so illegally. This is against laws of how one is supposed to deal with protests. Right, so that's one definite important media issue. Another is that, you know, this is being reported as a protest at the border, but this is not an international border. This is actually, you know, a line that Israel has drawn. Israel is sovereign in both sides of it. Israel Israel is sovereign in Israel and Israel is sovereign over Gaza because it controls the movement of people in and out of Gaza and it controls the movement, obviously, of goods in and out of Gaza. So it's not a border protest, right? It's easy to think of it that way, but it actually isn't, right? So those are some of the media narratives that I'm pushing against or want to push against. But I was actually amazed to see all those split screens coming up in so many places, including on The Times, where the picture of the protest is big and the picture of the ceremony at the embassy is small. And I think that, you know, it was a dramatic and terrifying day. And I'm glad that people were able to absorb even a little bit of that. Mm. It was a stunning thing.
I'd like to ask everybody, maybe starting with you, Susanna, how does this change our general grasp of Trump as a phenomenon? It seems to me, you know, in this very old, stuck, awful situation, there's something about Donald J. Trump that surfaces the contradictions that were inherently there. And to some degree, partly because nobody likes Donald Trump, he enables a conversation that we wouldn't be having. If Hillary Clinton had won the presidential election, who knows what would happen, but we wouldn't be talking about it with this sense of, wow, we've got to do better. Susanna, what does it tell you about...
What you're saying, and I agree with you, we are being forced now to talk in very serious ways about what we're all about in our lives, in our society. But I think we should also remember that the consequences of Trump's election aren't simply to enable conversation on a deeper level, but they've been devastating for a lot of people. And he has unleashed demons into this society and into this world that I fear will take centuries to get rid of. And those are demons of racism and anti-Semitism and misogyny. What are we going to do? Why do people like him? Why are they voting for him? Why are we living in this era of moral vulgarity? What's the appeal of this disgusting person?
Well, it's an old argument whether things have to get worse in order to get better. If institutions or moments or times have to reach kind of full bloom before they die, and I don't want to argue it too precisely, but he this era does surface anxieties, contradictions that we can finally notice and agree on, that they must be discussed. To me, see, I'm a journalist after all, but discussion is the beginning of every remedy. Reality,
of course,
conversation,
of course.
Reporting.
It's important. But people say that when they've gone through a terrible illness and they have terrible cancer and they recover, they appreciate life all the more. So perhaps it's something analogous. But, of course, we've brought this on ourselves. Of course, the other question is, whom are we talking to, actually? Do we just talk with people, as you know, people we agree with? And that's what's so worrisome. I worry about it within the Jewish community. People are so divided now. Those who support Trump don't want to talk to the people who can't stand him and so forth, including on views regarding Israeli politics and our relationship to Zionism. I think what happened in Jerusalem was also staged not for Jews, but for Christian evangelicals, framed with those two pastors who were imported from the United States. Who chose them?
Yeah, I was wondering, who thought that up?
And who wanted this?
Who decided that the base that you're working for, Mr. President, is not Jews in Israel or in the United States, but Christian fundamentalists.
Yes, Zionism has now become a Christian evangelical phenomenon, and they're pushing it. And I think, in fact, that's very dangerous for all of us and something to be taken quite seriously. What is Zionism for Jews? Not the way Bibi is enacting it.
Jihad, I'd like to ask you in particular, do we agree with the proposition that I came to believe, that the Middle East is unable to solve its own problems, get out of its own predicament, that the only American politics, change in American politics, can rescue this situation. That was a popular notion before Donald Trump, but I wonder what you think. I mean, is the United States, in fact, the real forum of this whole argument?
For sure. For general and particular reasons that have to do with Palestine and with the entire world. I mean, first of all, the United States is the number one provider of military aid to the state of Israel. You know, and every year, $3.8 billion. Go from the pockets of American taxpayers to fund and support Israel's military machine. But to talk in like broadly about your question, well, I think that a progressive America, a real progressive America, would be a guarantee for at least saving or safeguarding some of the principles that are at stake right now on a global level. I mean, we're witnessing the collapse of the post-World War II order, which, by the way, I mean, the responsibility of violating the principles and values that my colleague Susanna referred to earlier, that were agreed upon by the international community to rule the way states and countries and actors on the global level relate to each other. The chief responsibility of violating these values and principles and not uplifting them is a Western responsibility. I mean, the Korea War was one of the first wars that were fought after World War II, and hundreds of thousands of people were killed. The 1956 war, the Suez War, a war that Israel, France, and Britain launched on Egypt and the Palestinians in 1956. So the Western world and the United States involved did not take seriously these values and principles in Korea, in Vietnam, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And that's why now you have figures like Donald Trump, who are prophets of a new order that stands on the basis of pure interest and lack of any appreciation of any human value. And basically, he speaks the language of business. I mean, look, the way he conducts international politics, it's as if we are in some sort of a dystopian version of even the capitalism we're living in right now. So I think what needs to happen in the U.S., and this is not only about Palestine, it's about Palestine, it's about people of color, it's about black people in America, it's about immigrants, it's about refugees, it's about Yemenis and Syrians and Iraqis and Afghans, it's about climate change. The world needs a larger and a shift towards progressive politics, or otherwise it will be the demise of humanity.
It needs we've got to catch an entirely different wave. Amal Bashara, I want your take on Trump, the Trump problem, the Trump opportunity, the Trump phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I've been personally kind of organizing for 70 years of Nakba for months and months and months. Because I knew it was a big day for me, for so many people I love and care about, because the Nakba changed our lives, right? Now, there was that temporality of knowing that 70 years was coming up, and then all of a sudden we knew about this embassy thing. I couldn't believe it was really going to happen the day before Nakba Day. And then I wake up on the morning, and when I woke up, it was 7 Palestinians killed. By the end of the day, it was 58, and when I woke up the next day, it was, 60. It was a terrifying temporality, and it mobilized people in a terrifying way. So we had a rally, which I think, was much bigger because of the horrific violence that Palestinians had seen and that the world had seen perpetrated against Palestinians. And this was a rally that, from the beginning, had many, many allies and supporters coming together, including, of course, some of the strongest organizers in this city for Palestinian rights are Jewish Voice for Peace and Jewish organizations, as well as many other progressive organizations, people of color, and on a national level, we see the Dream Defenders movement. We see the Black Solidarity Statement for Palestinians. We see many ways in which people are connecting. Palestinians are trying to connect also to the Standing Rock movement and to other indigenous justice movements. That predates Trump. It's building now. I don't think it's good that we have this ridiculous challenge and this incredible amount of violence to cope with, including the violence, as Susanna and Jihad have noted, of this incredible racism we hear over and over again. But we will work through it. You know, Palestinians have been struggling for 70 years. People wanting justice have been as well for longer.
Susanna, I want to summon a very short blessing from your father. How do you start a moral movement in a moment of deep distress?
You know, it starts with the individual and with the person looking into himself or herself and remembering what kind of a person you want to become. You're given a life. What do you want to create out of it? What values do you want to create? Because it's not enough just to, let's say, to be a Jew. What do you stand for?
We got to all get busy. Susanna Herschel, thank you. Thank you, Amal Bishara, Steve Simon, Jihad Abu Salim. Thanks also to Sarah Sandmill. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Doné, Jane Yang, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.